Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Questions will be taken at the end of the presentation, and to raise your question over the phone, please press star followed by one on your telephone keypad. Today's call is being recorded, and if you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. Now, I would like to hand the call over to your host, Mr. Russell Agnew. Please go ahead, sir.
Okay, thank you very much, operator, and good morning, everybody. So, today is the latest session of our trusty teleconference. My name's Russell Agius, and I'm a scheme actuary here at Aon Hewitt. Now, my role today will be to chair the call, and it's the latest in a quarterly set of calls that we have, which focus on the topical pension issues of the day. These calls are actually due to supplement our regular trusty training courses, if some of you have been on those. And if you'd like more information on those, please stay on the line afterwards. You'll be pleased to hear that you will have the opportunity to ask questions at the end of today's call. So you can jot down some thoughts as you go along, and we'll open the line up a bit later on. So without further ado, let's introduce the speakers for this morning. Joining me today on the call are Paul McGlone and Ollie Walker. Guys, you want to say a few words?
Yes, hello, I'm Paul McGlone. Like Russell, I'm also a scheme actuary. I spend most of my time advising trustee boards.
And I'm Ollie Walker. I sit on the other side of the fence to Paul and Russell, advising companies on their funding valuation.
Okay, thanks, guys. So I think the good thing about that is you'll hear both the trustee and the corporate angle from today's call. So, topic for today. The main theme will be pension scheme funding. Clearly, it's a huge topic and forms an important part of the discussions that take place between trustees and companies at the current time. The particular aspects we're going to cover are the following. Firstly, 2013 valuations and what we're either already seeing or expecting to see as part of the discussions there. What the pension regulator has been saying and is actually now doing. Thirdly, the pickup in gilt yields since the start of the year and whether and how that should be allowed for and what it means in practice. And lastly, how trustees and companies are actually working together in practice to bridge the deficits that are likely to be larger as compared to 3 years ago. So then, to set the scene and to begin with, Ollie, perhaps you can give us a bit brief recap on what's been happening since the last valuations in 2010.
Yeah, thanks, Russell. As ever, it's been an interesting 3 years, but let's get this off to a good start and talk about the positive news. Assets have actually been doing really well. The FTSE's up about 40% since the last valuation, and that combined with the large deficit contributions that companies have been paying in means that average scheme assets have probably grown by about a quarter. So that's about 100 million extra in assets if we think about the FTSE 100 companies alone. But I say mixed bag, and the continued impact of quantitative easing means that liabilities have been growing at a similar rate as gilt yields have been falling. As a result, what you'll probably find is that for most schemes, their funding levels at a pretty similar level to where it was about 3 years ago, despite all those extra contributions going in. But because assets and liabilities are both bigger, what this means in terms of pounds amounts is that your deficit is probably bigger. But this on its own is very dependent on the characteristics of your own scheme. As a rough rule of thumb, those schemes that have long durations, perhaps two-thirds of your members still to retire, will find that they've fared worse as a result of quantitative easing and therefore looking at bigger deficits than those with short durations where the majority of members have now retired.
Okay, so coming back on that funding point. So percentage-wise, we may be the same as we were broadly 3 years ago, but in terms of the actual monetary amount of the deficit, that could be significantly more.
That's right.
Okay. So what's been driving all this change?
Yeah, it's been interesting stuff going on in the economies, and perhaps easiest to break that down into two parts. What happened in between your valuations, and then what's been going on in the global economy in the 6 months since, say, a March valuation date? So if we look at in-between valuations, gilt yields have fallen significantly, down around 2% from where they would have been at 4.5% last time you looked, perhaps 2.5% this time around. That on its own would add about 40% to your liabilities, some pretty big numbers. What's been driving this is the weaker than expected recovery from the recession. And so all those risk-averse investors out there have demanded more and more safe haven assets, such as gilts, to put their money into. Indeed, the demand for UK gilts in particular, that drives our funding targets, has been particularly high as investors have become more and more concerned about the risk of contagion in Europe from the likes of Greece and the risk that poses to the single currency. At the same time, central banks have kept up their quantitative easing programme with no signs of interest rates going up, which has been pushing up the price of gilts and therefore pushing down yields. At one point, the Bank of England owned around a third of the UK gilt market, something that's pretty unheard of. Interesting, there's another side to quantitative easing that perhaps gets picked up less in the pension press, which is the fact that you need a home for all this money that's coming into the market, and that's been piling into equities, pushing up those, and hence the fact that I talked about assets actually doing pretty well. So that was the first part in between valuations. If you think what's happened since your valuation date, we're back to good news. Gilt yields since March are actually up about 1%, so getting back half of those losses on the liabilities. This has largely been driven by the US Federal Reserve's announcement back in May that they were going to taper off their US quantitative easing program, and indeed might end it as soon as next year. They'd previously had an open-ended program, and investors kind of were not expecting this and rather taken by surprise. And it's caused a fundamental shift in investors' mindset, thinking now that we might be into the next stage of recovery. And so they're now starting to think about when rather than if interest rates are going up and becoming less keen on sitting in gilts. So if we take all of that together, what it means is, say, you're broadly where you would have been at the last valuation if we just look at your valuation date. But on the upside, since then, there's been a significant pickup in funding levels, which could be by as much as 10%. So certainly not something I would expect schemes can ignore. And as a corporate advisor, I know companies won't be shying away from raising that.
The trustees need to be on their toes to react, no doubt, to corporate considerations where the funding level has significantly improved in recent times.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, now during this time, and I kind of discussed this with a lot of trustees I work with, there were various statements with the pensions regulator. Paul, perhaps you can give us a summary on what the regulator is now looking at from trustees, given what's been happening.
Yeah, absolutely. The regulator's issued a number of statements on funding recently, so it's probably worth going back to the one in April 2012 to start with.
Okay.
He issued a statement in April 2012 that talked a lot about flexibility, and this was in an environment where funding positions in 2012 compared to where they'd been 3 years earlier were particularly bad. And at the time, there was a belief by the regulator that despite those difficult conditions, there was enough existing flexibility in the framework that schemes should be able to deal with it with only modest increases in either contributions or the length of their recovery plan. And the emphasis was very much about not making adjustments to assumptions, so not adjusting to allow for low gilt yields, either in discount rates or assuming yields were going to revert, but by accepting you had a low deficit, a very high deficit, and then dealing with it through either slightly higher contributions or slightly longer funding plans. The message at that time on contributions was to expect contributions of at least the current level in real terms. So it was very much expect to continue at the current level and try and get some more if you can. Now that changes when we get to the April 2013 statement in a moment. I'll come on to that in a second. The final piece, though, in the April 2012 statement was around financial management plans and the idea that trustees should be bringing together funding, investment and covenant in their discussions and be thinking about contingency planning. So that was the regulator's message in April 2012.
Have we seen these messages actually translate into real change, though, in terms of the regulator's approach?
We have. I mean, it's mixed because the regulator has lots of people who are all going off talking to schemes, and so it does depend a little on the individual you get. But for example, I was with a client recently where the regulator came to talk to them about funding, and what surprised the trustees was that the first question they got asked wasn't about funding, but was about conflicts and how they deal with them. The second question was about the covenant and the strength of the sponsor. Even the third set of questions weren't about funding, they were about investment strategy. And it was only after the regulator had got through the conflicts and the covenants and the investment strategy, they then started to move on to, now let's talk about funding. Now, I'm not saying everyone will have that experience, but certainly there are a number of people at the regulator who are already looking at things more holistically.
I think that's quite an interesting interesting anecdote there, because certainly our trustee boards that I look after, we wouldn't have expected that type of approach and type of questions that do need to be able to be answered immediately, but at the same time may not have been expected when the focus is on funding. Tell me, that was the April 2012 statement. What about the more recent one you mentioned?
Yeah, so April 2012 came out, and soon after that statement, the regulator announced that his intention was then to produce an annual statement to guide people through the funding process. So the April 2013, actually it was May 2013 by the time it came out, had some similar themes, but there were some quite important differences. The first was on assumptions that the emphasis had changed from don't make any changes to allow for yields into something that said, actually, we recognise that the relative returns of different asset classes may change between valuations, which is code for saying, yes, you can probably make some allowance and assume that you get additional returns on your growth assets relative to your gilts.
Mm-hmm.
Effectively, that gives even more flexibility in the framework, although whether trustees will want to take account of that is a different question. The other change, which is important, was on contributions, where the move was to say, the new wording said, see whether the current level of contributions can be maintained. Now, if you compare that to April 2012, where it said at least the same in current terms, the emphasis seems to have changed from the existing contributions being a minimum, which you should try and get more than, to one where they're treated almost as a maximum, and you can go below that if it's justifiable.
That could be seen as a wholesale change.
It could be. It's quite a subtle change of wording, but I think it's quite important, and I'm sure Ollie will tell us how the corporate advisors have picked up on that. And the third change in wording was to drop the phrase complete financial management plan, but to move to wording that talked about an integrated approach to funding. And I think that reflects in practice the view that while everybody thinks that integrated decision making is sensible, most people don't see any value in creating a single all singing all dancing document. So I think that's a less important change, but it's a helpful one to confirm that we don't need to all go and create this big document. So overall, the last statement adds more flexibility. A number of companies and advisors have used it as an opportunity to push back on trustees, though, and that that's caused a few difficulties.
Yeah, I think that's it. And as Russell mentioned, don't be surprised if your company starts coming to you quoting bits from this statement, such as trustees making greater use of the flexibility, starting point, considering current level of contributions and whether they can be maintained. Mm. A particular favourite for companies, and I quote, is that the assumption shouldn't be neither overly prudent or optimistic. You might see people pushing for best estimates. And one we love was that outside of this statement, the pensions regulator has been quoted as saying trustees are not expected to be overly prudent. Something that's quickly been jumped on by companies. I think the other interesting side is from the industry perspective, as you say, the NAPF was very supportive of the statement, complementing the shift away from last year's heavy bias on basing investment return assumptions on those risk-free rates. But on the other side, CBI, perhaps more representative companies in general, whilst sort of pleased and acknowledging a better statement for it, was more restrained and said this statement was just the start of the process and that businesses will be looking for a clear step change in the regulator's behaviour with the new objective reflected in every single speech, statement and code of practice.
Mm. Yes, you mentioned there the new objective. Could you want to remind us what that's all about?
Yeah, this is something companies have very much been pushing for. At the moment, TPR has two objectives. The first one is to protect the pension protection fund, and the second is to protect members' benefits. So if you think about that, that naturally drives the regulator to want to get as much money into pension schemes as quickly as possible. Mm. And there have been those campaigning that that's actually detrimental to the country as a whole, as it's sucking money out of the economy. Therefore, following industry pressure, the government published a third draft objective for the regulator, which is, and I'll quote it, to minimise any adverse impact on the sustainable growth of an employer. Mm. So that all sounds like good news and something that companies will look for. It's already been debated in Parliament, but if you look at the minutes, it didn't get a lot of airtime, with no real objections in there. So expectations are this third objective will come into play next year when it gets royal assent. Mm. So that's going to be in time for the regulator's next round of his funding statements, but actually it's probably going to be, unfortunately for companies, a bit late for this valuation.
Yeah, you say it's a bit late, but I'm certainly getting pressure on a number of valuations to consider this, even though it's on its way. So, okay, that's been a useful recap as to what's been happening. Let's now turn to what trustees and companies are seeing presently and how trustees are actually reacting to that. Paul, let's pick up on that.
Yes, well, trustees are reacting in all manner of different ways, and in fact, the range of approaches that we're seeing has probably never been wider. Before getting into the details, such as assumptions and things, I think it's worth saying that the starting point for trustees should be to understand the role that the technical provisions actually play in their particular scheme. Now, technical provisions are something which we all have to produce and we all have to submit them to the regulator. But while they're clearly important, they're not always the be-all and end-all. There are some cases where technical provisions are simply a box-ticking exercise, perhaps not subject to a lot of discussion and debate between the company and trustees, because it's other issues which are considered to be more important. One of those might simply be the contributions that can be afforded. If schemes have got long-term plans in place for de-risking and reaching a self-sufficiency target or a buyout target, then again, the technical provisions may not be the measure that everybody's focused on. A number of schemes now have a long-term target which is beyond the technical provisions, which may be a gilts basis or maybe a buyout target, and that's the most important discussion, with the technical provisions simply being another measure to use along the way. In some cases, however, technical provisions are the most important discussion that trustees will be having with the sponsor, and they will drive the contributions being paid. And in those cases, the guidance from the regulator is very important, and the flexibility that exists within that regime is important. So I say, I think the most important thing is for you to understand the context of where the technical provisions sit and which are the most important discussions for you to be having.
But I reiterate that. For the successful valuation negotiations I see, it's where the company and trustee have sat down up front and looked to understand each other's objectives and their key aims from that valuation. So I think trustees going through that and understanding where the employer's coming from can be very helpful. For all my company clients, they want to have a sensible discussion around long-term plans and how they can work with the trustee to de-risk the scheme. And in many cases, they're actually willing to pay some additional contributions to get to the point where there is more certainty over their future contribution budgeting. However, that quite often, though, comes through with a general reluctance from employers to commit to those targets by the technical provisions themselves. Mm. And there's a few reasons for that. Firstly, it could be because increasing technical provisions causes them problems from an accounting or tax perspective. So they'd rather do that outside on a secondary funding target. It may be back to the affordability, and there's a lack of cash in the short term, and it doesn't want technical provisions there for to make it unaffordable. Or, and what perhaps most common is, there's just a general nervousness from companies about losing flexibility in the funding by committing to strengthen the regulatory framework via the technical provisions. Again, they'd just rather have that flexibility outside. So working through with your employer to understand those constraints, I think, will make for a much more productive valuation discussion and some chats around that long-term plan.
Okay, so it sounds like technical revisions are there, they're needed, but as you say, they don't always have to be the be-all and end-all. There may be other ways of the companies and trustees working together to achieve a kind of viable outcome for both parties. Okay, digging down a level, so within the technical provisions, the assumptions that are generating the most debate this time round, Ollie, is it the usual suspects? Or are things changing?
Yeah, very much the usual suspects. I'd say the usual three key assumptions to be making sure you look at. The first being the assumed investment returns that you're allowing for.
Yeah.
The second is the old chestnut around life expectancy and where to have your assumption this time. And the third is what you think inflation will do in the long term. And perhaps more particularly, what your expectations are around those two different inflation measures, CPI and RPI, and how they interact. So if we take this in turn, starting off with assumed investment returns. The key here is we talked about low gilt yields, and with low gilt yields, you shouldn't just assume that your discount rate will still have the same margin for expected returns over and above that gilt yield. For example, if you had a discount rate last time around of gilts plus 1.5% pre-retirement or 0.5% post, don't automatically assume it will be 1.5% again this time. And we can look back at the regulator's statement in May, where he rightly said that the return or the relative return on different asset classes may rise and fall since the preceding valuation. So whilst I talked about gilt yields having fallen 2% over the period, our views around future investment returns and other asset classes haven't actually fallen by anything like as much. For example, if we look at equities, if your equity return assumption last time around was perhaps gilts plus 4%, we'd be saying this time around it might be more like gilts plus 6%. So to give you a feel for what this might mean for your average scheme's discount rate, if we apply that methodology to a gilts plus 1.5% pre, half post, you'd actually end up with a discount rate more like gilts plus 2% pre and gilts plus 0.7% post.
Yeah, I mean, there's from a trustee perspective, that is an area where undoubtedly trustees will want to push back. When you hear numbers such as equities might return gilts plus 6, I think most trustees would raise an eyebrow at that. And while there's some justification in that, and I accept there's some justification in these arguments, any increase in the discount rate relative to gilts does mean that your target is now further away from what you might call a risk-free level of funding, and in theory that should be supported by stronger covenants. It also raises a question about what happens if yields rise back again.
Yeah.
So if companies are pushing for higher levels of outperformance when yields are low, that's fine, but you can equally be sure that they'll try and avoid reducing the outperformance when yields rise back again.
I'm sure they wouldn't do that.
But I suppose there are different ways of allowing for this outperformance, though. It could be both within the technical revisions, but also within the recovery plan. So presumably we're seeing more activity focused on the recovery plan?
Yeah, that's certainly my experience. But the valuations I've been doing over the past year, actually, and my company clients have chosen to keep the margin on the technical revisions the same, but allow for a much higher asset return in the recovery plan. Mm. That ends up with a very similar level of contributions being paid, but actually as trustee are much more comfortable and it makes for a simpler valuation discussion. And likewise, if the trustee are in the same place, if yields do rise in future and the employer would expect it to work vice versa.
Mm. Yeah, and I would say I've seen the same from a trustee perspective, that trustees are much more comfortable with that sort of approach.
Yeah. So number two on assumptions to look at was your longevity. Good news here is a lot of the hard work was probably done for many schemes last time around for the valuation. So around three quarters of schemes in 2010 moved to the new SAPS base tables and also a new set of improvement tables called the CMI tables. So what you'd be looking at this time is actually just making sure you update those to pick up the latest set of those tables. And also have a look back and check that your benchmarking of those tables to your own scheme experience is still appropriate for example, by using the Aon Hewitt longevity model. If you're in the quarter of, or if you're in the quarter of schemes who didn't update their assumptions last time around, then you might be in for a bit of a windfall this time, because actually the CMI improvement tables assume a quicker falling off in life expectancy than was built into the medium or long cohort tables, which will result in a slightly lower liability. I think where you'll find, as ever, there'll be more debate is around that long-term rate of improvement. And our house view as Aon Hewitt is that the long-term rate of improvement probably have gone up by about 0.25% since the last round of valuations. What I would say is just one word of caution here. Often see companies and trustees spend an awful long time, potentially months, debating that particular detail of long-term rate of improvement and whether it's going to be 1.25% or 1.5%. In actual fact, in terms of the liabilities, it has a relatively small impact, perhaps only as much as 1% increase in the liabilities, which is dwarfed when you think about some of the other assumptions like the discount rate. So equivalent of a 1% increase for the discount rate is about 0.05% on it. Effectively, that's just rounding. Therefore, I'd suggest that make sure you've got your benchmarking right, you've got the right tables, but perhaps be just a bit proportionate in how much time you give to the debate around the long-term underpin.
Okay, Paul, surely you'd like to spend lots of time as a trustee advisor talking about mortality.
I love to spend lots of time talking about mortality, and it's fascinating. But I think, as Ollie said, spending a disproportionate amount of time that doesn't make sense. Yeah. And one of the things that trustees can certainly do is collect the evidence so that they're talking about this from an informed position rather than from an uninformed position. If you're large enough, then certainly collecting evidence based on your own experience is possible. Even if you're not large enough, it's quite straightforward nowadays to access things like postcode-based models where you can look at your membership, look at their postcodes, look at their income levels, and actually get a reasonably good view about a reasonably good and objective view about what future life expectancy might look like.
Absolutely. And from a company's perspective, again, that's really important when you're thinking around de-risking and really understanding the characteristics of your scheme.
I guess, it's all, I mean, from a company's perspective, it's also important in their accounting figures. So yep. Hopefully trustees pushing for an objective view on mortality will get support.
Yep. I've seen one case recently where, compared to 3 years ago, you know, we did choose postcoding, and there's quite a lot of stability, certainly in the base table there, compared to 3 years ago. Membership hasn't changed a lot. So I think if you can get that, then it's a nice reason to be in. But we did mention three assumptions.
Let me not forget the third, which is inflation, or as I said, really focusing on what the difference between CPI and RPI inflation is. So whilst most schemes made some allowance for this at the last valuation, it's a case of revisiting to make sure that allowance is appropriate. So in 2010, the expected gap between CPI and RPI was around 0.7% a year, and many schemes in their funding valuation rounded that down to about 0.5%. At the end of last year, there were various proposed changes to that from the Chancellor in terms of how RPI would be set going forward, which caused a lot of volatility in that market and where that assumption might be. Mm. In the end, none of that happened, and our latest best estimate of the gap is increased to 0.9%. Well, I would say difference between 0.5 and 0.9 could be quite significant, so something to come back and have a look at.
Okay.
Yeah, again, I agree with that. Although, as a trustee advisor, if it's moved from 0.5 to 0.9 in such a short period, then I may want to be a little prudent. It's also important that it varies a lot from scheme to scheme. Some schemes move to CPI for a lot of their benefits, and this is a very important assumption. Other schemes are still on RPI for almost everything, and therefore it's an assumption you don't want to spend really any time on at all.
Okay, good. I echo that as well. Okay, so what's actually interesting looking at those three assumptions is how the focus between the different assumptions varies at different valuations. It looks like the three key assumptions remain key, but you spend more time on different assumptions depending on what's happened in the interim. So let's move on and look at the pickup in funding levels since March of this year. Ollie's already mentioned that they've had positive market experience, both in terms of rising gilt yields, real yields there, and strong returns on growth assets in particular. So, Paul, implications of these improvements?
Okay, so schemes who are looking at valuations this year tend to fall into two camps. Those who have 31st December or 1st of January 13 valuations, yep. and those with either 31st of March or a 6th of April valuation. So looking at the December and January valuations, since then, fixed interest yields have risen quite a lot, and that will have reduced any non-increasing liabilities that you've got by probably over 10%. Equities have also returned something like 15% year to date. And so for schemes with December and January valuations, there will have been a noticeable pickup. Ollie mentioned earlier, perhaps 10% improvement in funding position. If you've got a March or an April valuation, actually most of the equity return this year you'd already had, and that will be in your asset figures at the end of March or the start of April. But the position at 31st of March was that yields were even lower, particularly index-linked yields were even lower. And again, they've risen a lot since. So for those schemes, equities won't have given you an awful lot since your valuation date, but you'll have had a much bigger impact on your liabilities falling. So for different reasons, whether you've got a December or a March valuation date, you will have seen a similar issue, which is your funding level at the valuation date may be similar to where it was 3 years ago, but since then it's probably been quite a substantial improvement.
Okay, and which types of screens have been affected most?
Well, it does depend on, as you say, on the type of scheme. One is, in fact, a lot of it is to do with the investment strategy you've got rather than the nature of the scheme itself. One is the level of hedging of interest rates and inflation, and the other is the exposure you've got to equities. So if your scheme is very well hedged against changes in interest rates and inflation, then as yields rise, your liabilities do fall, but your hedging position will mean that your assets have fallen as well to match it. And so you won't have seen the same pickup since the valuation date, but then you shouldn't have seen the same downward trend in the first place. The second is the equity investments, and if you've got a strong, a large holding of equities, you'd have seen the benefits of that. If you've diversified a lot of your return-seeking assets elsewhere, you won't have seen the same sort of impact. So in practice, you need to ask your scheme actuary, investment consultants, how you've been affected since the valuation date.
Okay. And Ollie, if you turn to the corporate, surely you're not going to let the trustees get away with rectifying a high deficit back in March. Surely you're going to want to do something about that, aren't you?
Yeah, it's mixed. I've got my clients falling into two camps. There are those that have agreed their long-term targets and they're willing to carry on paying contributions because they want to get that contribution certainty I talked about earlier.
Yes.
But, right, probably the majority of my clients want to share in some of this upside or the upturn in the market to reduce their contribution bit, to keep some money in the business. So in those cases, what they'll be looking for is either that we ask the scheme actuary to sign off the valuation at a date nearer to now, so it will naturally capture some of that upside, or that they'll look to the trustees to be more relaxed when we come to setting the technical provision assumptions, given what we've seen since and that we know we've had positive experience.
And Paul, how are the trustees going to react to that?
Well, schemes with 2013 valuations, this is probably a new issue to grapple with, but actually it's something that those with other valuation cycles have seen before. So in 2010 valuations, most funding positions worsened, so the last time that this group of trustees had a valuation, they didn't face this. But those with 2009 and 2012 valuations did face exactly this issue, where the funding position improved substantially after the valuation date. And generally, trustees were comfortable in making allowance for that in some way. Typically, the improvement was used to shorten recovery plans rather than allowing for lower contributions, although in some cases, lower contributions were agreed. Often, trustees made the point that if we're going to allow for positive experience after this valuation, then that sets a precedent, and if we see awful experience after the next valuation, we'll expect to take that into account as well.
Yes.
And of course, you've got the practical point that in any improvements that we've seen since the valuation date can only be allowed for in the valuation if they still exist when the valuation is signed off. and if they disappear before the valuation is signed off, then they certainly can't be allowed for. And that often created a little bit of incentive for trustees and companies to agree things a little bit faster than they might otherwise have done.
Yeah, okay, understand. Okay, so that's useful to understand. I think we'll see more of those than we have in the past, but you know, there are some issues to overcome. Okay, let's dig a little deeper. I'm interested to understand a bit more about how trustees and companies are working close together, and to do that, it would be useful to understand what exactly or what types of things are on the agenda from the company perspective. So, Wally, perhaps you could help.
Yeah, I don't think anything particularly unexpected in terms of what companies' objectives are. There's to maintain cash in the business to the extent they think better use for it, minimise the risk of contributions increasing, particularly when it comes to budgeting. An unexpected increase in contributions is hard for finance directors. As I said earlier, they're willing to pay a premium in order to reduce that risk. And there's the old one around wanting to avoid the risk of a surplus. We've seen yields up 1% in 6 months. How much more can they go up, and are we actually heading back to that optimistic time of surpluses, if not on a funding basis, at least on an accounting basis?
Goodness me, surpluses already. You've only just got rid of the deficits. Any particular examples or anecdotes you can share with us?
Yeah, I'll pull out a few. On the surplus point, it's always looking at whether you could use contingent assets in order to get some security and see how things pan out. It's interesting looking at the PPS data. I think they've got in there about a third of schemes having some form of contingent asset. Mainly that's a parent guarantee, but it's becoming increasingly common. In terms of thinking about how to deal with the fact markets and funding positions have changed a lot since the valuation date, I've got a couple of examples of ways that was done. One was where the company actually agreed to the higher technical provisions, increased contributions, but they wrote into the schedule of contributions, the legal document, that there's a break at which we'll look at how the funding's done before a contribution is paid, and if on an approximate basis we're actually ahead of target, then that contribution won't be paid. I think this is nice because it's a fairly low-cost way of finding a compromise that avoids the need for the company expecting they'll have to do a long-winded valuation in order to turn off the tap. Similarly, I've seen it done the other way, where the trustee agreed a lower schedule of contributions to recognise the upturn, but with the agreement documented and minuted that if that doesn't carry on when we come to the next valuation, the company will carry on paying contributions at its current rate, so they'll be no worse off. I've got one neat one I'll just throw in, given we talked a bit about surpluses. I am lucky I have a client that's in surplus, and the trustee are grappling with the issue of what to do with their current contributions, whether they should drag out the valuation or force the company to carry on paying those. In this case, the company's agreed to pay them to an escrow account, so the trustee will continue getting the same level of security, but with a review clause in there that those contributions could come back to the company if markets stay as they currently are.
Okay, interesting. Paul, anything to add? Any examples?
I'll just throw in one. I think there's lots and lots of examples of this sort of thing, but one I'd throw in is a case recently where the company wanted to undertake a liability management exercise but couldn't commit to both the cash for that exercise and the contributions to fund the deficit. So what they agreed in the end was that an amount was withheld for liability management, but anything that wasn't spent on that would automatically flow into the scheme to fund the deficit at a later date. And as the trustees effectively had to approve any liability management before it took place, that really put them in quite a comfortable position, because if they approved it and it went ahead, then it was positive to the scheme. And if they didn't feel it was positive to the scheme, then they'd get the contributions.
I understand. Okay. Ollie, sorry, there's one point you want to come in on there.
Let me mention a final thought on funding valuations, and one that often gets forgotten, which is around the future service cost.
Yes.
This quite often gets left to the end when everything else has been agreed. But given the low gilt yields, actually the impact of that on your future service cost is much more significant than it is on your TPs, and you could see that going up by as much as 50% if you just apply the same methodology. which is going to hit a company's P&L or a contributions in a big way. So there's ways that you can deal with that. I would encourage trustees, therefore, to make sure they ask their scheme actuary to calculate the future service cost early on and put that on the table and start having some discussions, rather than leaving it to the end and finding you're fraught and trying to rush through how to get something across the line.
Yeah, I'd add to that. I've just seen a case just these last few days where our future service cost went from 15% to 25% because of aging of the population, because it's a closed group and yields. And when you take off a fixed 5% member contribution, that means the company rate goes from 10 to 20. And that's quite a shock when you pass that piece of paper across the table.
Especially, I suppose, when you've also got auto-enrolment and all these additional payments from employers. So I suppose from the employer's perspective, it's looking at the overall contribution budget, not just deficit, not just future service, but all their pension schemes and all the amounts going in.
Yeah, just quite often the future service rate gets focused because it gets sent to different divisions, and then they'll start complaining that it's gone up double in this case.
Yeah.
So just careful to not leave it.
Okay, good. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to open the lines up in a minute or two, so please have your questions ready if you'd like to ask our speakers anything in particular. Before we do that, though, let me summarise some of the points from our discussions this far. So, firstly, then, we've heard both from Paul and Ollie that it's important to understand the role of the technical provisions, whether it's fundamental to the pension scheme or whether it's more of a tick box exercise and actually a longer term target, it is of more importance. So where the technical provisions sit in the spectrum of funding measures is going to be important. Secondly, we're expecting pension schemes to differentiate more between the discount rate to use to value the liabilities and the investment return that's incorporated within the recovery plan, and potentially a higher investment return than the discount rate if any outperformance is considered, perhaps more so than we've seen in previous valuations. Thirdly, don't be surprised if there's significant improvements since either 31 December or 31st of March. Most pension schemes will have experienced positive valuation results since then for a variety of reasons, but there should be improvements. Even in the last few days, real yields have increased quite substantially. And don't feel like you're getting, I suppose fourthly, don't feel like you're getting backed into a corner. There's clearly from discussion lots of creative ways in which we can reach acceptable positions all round. So now for the fun part. Operator, could you please open the lines to see whether we have any, or could you explain to the callers how to pose a question should they wish to ask one?
Yes, of course, thank you. If you would like to raise your question over the phone, please press star followed by 1 on your telephone keypad. Please unmute your phone and record your name clearly when prompted. Your name is required to introduce the question. And to withdraw the request, please press star 2. Once again, that will be star 1 to raise your question. One moment, please, for the first question.
Operator?
No questions raised, but once again, that'll be star 1.
Yep, that's no problem. I've got a question that I'd like to actually ask the speakers in the meantime, so whilst the callers are thinking about any questions they'd like to ask. So one that I'd like to ask is in relation to the contribution requirements. What are the circumstances, if any, where lower contributions should be considered this time round as compared to previous valuations, especially where the deficits have gone up? Any views on that, Paul?
Sorry. Well, from a trustee's perspective, never. No. I think a couple of things. One is clearly affordability is key. If trustees are convinced that the current level of contributions really is not affordable, then they have to accept a lower rate of contributions. The other situation I'd flag is timescales. If you have seen an improvement, to the point that the existing level of contributions is perhaps going to fill the deficit in a couple of years, then you might be very comfortable as a trustee saying, okay, we'll let it reduce and run it over, you know, perhaps 3, 4, 5 years rather than a very, very short period.
On that point, that's the approach I've used where clients have been in that situation that they expect to get to full funding earlier because of the market upturn. So we've kept, let's say, a 10-year recovery plan, but we'll pay contributions for 4 years of that, and then we'll expect the assets to get us there to the end, so carrying on at the current rate, but just shortening the time to get there. The other area is which companies are looking at, as I referred to earlier, is around alternative financing. And if the company's willing to put up some extra security in order to effectively substitute the contributions for a number of years whilst we see how markets turn out. So things like the use of an escrow account or a parent guarantee could certainly be ones where trustees could consider those and see if they're willing to be more relaxed on contributions in the short term.
And is the regulator comfortable with those? I always thought the regulator had a cash is king mentality. Is that not the case?
I think for me it depends on the type of security that's been put up. The regulator has put out some statements around the use of special purpose vehicles, which are one very particular type of alternative financing, and that might suggest they're a bit nervous about those. But if it comes to the use of cash in an escrow rather than the funds, then my experience has been pretty relaxed. And actually, if that helps trustees and companies reach a better outcome overall, then a good result.
Yeah, and the regulator, unless he sees something which he's really, really uncomfortable with, is probably not going to push back too hard. Ultimately, if the trustees are comfortable, that's the most important thing. So an example, talking about alternative financing, which Ollie mentioned recently, one of my clients was in a situation where we were trying to get higher contributions, company was pushing back, and what we agreed in the end was actually slightly lower contributions, but a parent company PPF style guarantee for the full buyout deficit. And you know what? A PPF style guarantee for the full deficit with no time constraints is pretty valuable.
Absolutely. Okay. Operator, can we see whether there are any questions at this time, please?
No questions raised at this point.
Okay, well, in that case, I'll ask one more, so I'm not going to let the speakers off the hook that easily. So my second question will be re-risking and de-risking. So we've heard a lot about de-risking and how we should be switching our assets generally from growth to protection, et cetera, et cetera. Given what's happening in the economy, we're seeing some signs of improvement. Should trustees and companies not be re-risking at this stage to take advantage of the recovery?
I know Talking to Paul's got a good example on this, so I'll just set out my thoughts first. Re-risking is something worth looking at, but in terms of looking at it, I would first of all check whether you need to re-risk and start thinking about where you're trying to get to. And actually, in many cases, people perhaps are closer to that end game than they think, and therefore don't just need to re-risk for the sake of it and risk the volatility that they've had in the past and potentially losing those funding.
Especially with the recent pickup as well.
Absolutely.
I think it's very individual. The example Ollie mentioned that I talked to him about earlier was a scheme which is currently contemplating changing their growth allocation from 5% to 60%, which is pretty serious change. Actually, for them, it may well be the right thing to do. I think their de-risking has gone too far too quickly, and they've reached the point of saying this is no longer appropriate. But I'd say it's very, very individual. It should always be on your agenda, but that doesn't mean you should all necessarily be doing it.
Okay, and I think that kind of brings us back to the kind of the third in the triangle, the linking covenant with investment strategy, which is something that the pension regulator is showing more interest in. And I think it's a topic in itself and probably something for another day. So I think we'll check. If there's no further questions, we'll end the call. Operator, any final questions?
Still no questions, Razor.
No. Okay, well, thank you, everybody, for dialing in. I hope the call's been of interest and of use to you in your day-to-day work. If you would like to ask the speakers any questions after the call, then please do use the emails, and we can pick up on those directly. Other than that, thank you very much for listening, and have a great day. Thank you very much.
Thank you, and that concludes today's call. You may go ahead and disconnect at this time.